you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross with you as always on this Friday. We are on air. We are online at laist.com and live streaming on Instagram at LAist Official, LAIST Official, where you can also join the conversation. Coming up, we are going to talk about how grief manifests in our dreams. Late night visits from loved ones. It can bring us comfort. Can also open old wounds, leave us feeling confused. We're going to talk about grief dreams, what they might mean, and I'll also want to hear about yours. Maybe you got something important from it that changed the nature of your grief. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But we start with an eye on Atlanta and a ruling in a case to determine whether Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis should be disqualified from leading an election interference case against former President Trump. It came after revelations that she was having a romantic relationship with the lead prosecutor in that case. That was Nathan Wade. This morning, a judge ruled that Willis can remain on the case, but one of them has got to go. We're going to talk about that. We're going to get you the details, fill you in if you haven't been following this case closely, but we're also going to look at some legal aspects as well. Let's start with Sarah Forden. She's a legal editor for Bloomberg News, and she's been following the latest. Welcome to you, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also on the line with us, Fred Smith Jr., a professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta. Welcome to you, Professor Smith.
It's great to be here.
Sarah, this all stemmed from an allegation made by a longtime GOP operative, one of former President Trump's co-defendants as well. Can you just give us a brief recap of what we saw leading up to the ruling this morning?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this case has produced some eye-popping revelations about a romantic affair that the chief prosecutor, Fani Willis, had with Nathan Wade, who was the lead prosecutor who she had hired to pursue the case. The judge at that point didn't stop the trial, but he focus the proceedings on several days of hearings over whether or not this relationship was in fact true and whether or not it constituted a conflict of interest and would cause Fani Willis and Nathan Wade to be removed from the case along with her entire office. So that was the kind of the lead up to the decision today.
And that question of truth, I'll come to you, Professor Smith. With this ruling, the judge, Scott McAfee, says an odor of mendacity or untruthfulness remains. I'm curious about your reaction to this being in Atlanta.
Sure. I mean, that is a striking line. And given the very measured tone of the opinion, that was not a line that I'm sure that the judge took lightly to include. And with that line, I think he is signaling that there might be other remedies that are beyond his jurisdiction or certainly beyond the reach of this particular motion. The question in front of him wasn't whether there is such an odor of mendacity, as he put it, but whether or not there was either an actual conflict or an appearance of a conflict. And he concluded that there was not an actual conflict. He concluded that there was an appearance of a conflict, but that the appearance was not of such a nature that it required for disqualification. But as has been noted, it does require either that her office remove itself from this case or that Nathan Wade be removed. And I think that the expectations by all watching is that it means that Nathan Wade will be removed.
We're talking about judge ruling this morning that Fani Willis, a DA in Georgia, can stay on the election interference case for former President Trump, but either her or the lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, is going to have to step aside in order for it to proceed. Sarah Forden, as we watch the case, as we watch the testimony play out, I mean, it got pretty dramatic, I gotta say. Like, it was, it almost felt like reality TV at some parts with the kind of like a surprise witness in there, or like a key witness, and then the testimony of DA Fani Willis herself. How did this all play out as people were watching it? It seems almost like a sideshow to the bigger issue at hand, which is a question over whether the former president did interfere in the 2020 election.
Well, in fact, I mean, Fani Willis herself pointed this out on the stand when she was testifying about her relationship with Wade. She said, you know, just let's remember, folks, that the actual people are who are on trial, you know, I'm not the one on trial, but it's the president, former president, and his aides. So this clearly kind of really threw the case into limbo, almost took it off the rails. But today was a significant win for Fani Willis, probably the biggest win of her career. She has asked for a trial date in August. It's still not clear if the judge will set it as soon as that. He still has other motions to go through. But even if Nathan Wade steps down, and his role in this case was primarily to bring the evidence before the special grand jury that led to the charges, she has hired two other extremely accomplished prosecutors in this case, Anna Cross and John Floyd. Floyd is actually the state's leading expert on racketeering law, and that's another element of this case. She has brought these charges under the RICO law, and so there's still a lot of, you know, potential for this case to go forward and get back on track.
I should be clear, as well as the romantic relationship, which was a large part of this case, there is this question of whether or not the lead attorney, Wade, was financially benefiting from it, or whether DA Fani Willis was benefiting from essentially the work that she was giving to the person that she may or may not have been seeing at the time, right?
Yes. So he was paid approximately $650,000 so far for his work on this case. And, you know, evidence came out that they had taken several vacations together. But they both denied that she benefited from, you know, his payments in that case. They claimed to have evenly split their travel expenses. And the judge ruled today that there was actually no proof that there was financial misconduct.
Professor Fred Smith, just following kind of the tick-tock of this, the timeline of how this all rolled out, I think that when it was first announced that DA Willis would go after former President Trump on election interference charges, there was a lot of excitement, even relief, I'd say, among Democrats in America especially, who kind of watched everything play out in 2020, 2021. And then there was this maybe collective groan as this case came to light, and as there were questions that could obviously give the Trump case a lot of room to question both the motivations or even the legitimacy of the case. Being in Atlanta and being in close proximity to the legal community there, what's been the sense, what's been the feeling when these allegations came about, and then as we watch the case play out, that, you know, the district attorney could have some real conflicts of interest here?
Sure. I mean, I think that the feeling has been concern. The feeling has been unwelcome attention to our city in terms of this, you know, this particular set of events. At the same time, I'd say that today the feeling is that this particular judge issued a very thoughtful opinion. It's consistent with Georgia's motto of wisdom, justice, moderation. I think this opinion reflects that spirit. You know, the question on the actual conflict was the fact that Nathan Wade is paid. That's, you know, that's true of every special prosecutor, and the judge acknowledged that, right? So that's baked into something that we all sort of accept. And there was no financial. So he asked, is there a financial interest in the conviction of these defendants? The answer was no. Is there a financial interest in the decision to prosecute? Was there a financial interest in that? He concluded no. Is there a financial interest in this being prolonged as a result of the payments? And the answer was no, and that if anything, Bonnie Willis has been trying to move the case along quickly, as you've acknowledged. But there were questions that remain about just the appearance at this point, how this is all perceived. And I think the judge reached a reasonable conclusion that in terms of how this is experienced, how this is felt, how people watching this unfold, what they've concluded, that there is an appearance of a conflict. And I think he reached a thoughtful middle ground remedy on that score.
Judge McAfee did write that, according to Georgia law, that this doesn't really, the law doesn't really permit the finding of an actual conflict for simply making bad choices. So he was clear to state that he's got to stay within the confines and stick to the relevant issues. But Professor, zooming out now, Trump's attorney, Steve Sato, is, planning to use all the legal options that they've got to dismiss this case. There are questions about whether the jury pool could, whether you could find a jury that doesn't actually have an opinion formed. I want to put this to you. Does this up the chances of dismissal? Does it up the chances of a not guilty verdict later down the line? What do you see?
I mean, I think he wrote an opinion that I find it very difficult to imagine it being reversed either now or down the line. And I think it's very clear that this isn't going to result in disqualification. There are some other remedies that he suggested might be in order. So he suggested that that he'd be open to the defendants filing a motion that prohibited the district attorney from publicly commenting on the case. And there's another, and he also just noted that there's other entities that have some responsibilities here, the General Assembly, which is our legislature, the State Ethics Commission, the State Bar of Georgia, the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, or the voters of Fulton County, acknowledging that there's going to be an election this year, and she's actually already drawn opposition in the primary. So there are other ways that this will manifest, but I don't think it would be in the way of a disqualification. I think that the questions around the jury pool are the same now, actually, as they were 6 months ago. People have, I think, a lot of potential jurors have opinions about this RICO case.
Talking right now about the big news this morning that DA Fani Willis, Fulton County, can stay on the Trump Georgia 2020 election interference case, but either her or the lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, may have to step down. Talking about it with Professor of Law at Emory University in Atlanta, Fred Smith Jr., and Sarah Forden, legal editor for Bloomberg News. Sarah, as Fred just mentioned there is a primary. I know that Fani Willis has both a Democratic challenger, then also a, how else you put it, MAGA challenger. What do we know about the state of this case and the primaries, which I think are coming up in, is it May for them?
Well, clearly the questions about her judgment are going to play in the political contest. But at the same time, she has a solid, backing of her supporters. I think the more critical issue for the case is really going to be the timing as we get into the general election. And, this is a very ambitious case. We have 15 defendants on trial under racketeering law. The judge has said if he goes forward, he's going to split that up into like at least three different groups. So this raises the prospects that the whole proceeding could then extend past the November election. And the Trump's lawyer, Steve Sato, has already said that if Trump is elected, he is going to move that this trial be postponed because you can't have a president on trial. So I think there are lots of questions here that even though we've seen this sort of win for Fani and for the Fulton County DA, there are bigger clouds that are potentially building over this case.
Professor Smith, no doubt this is messy on a career level for the DA, Fani Willis, as well as Nathan Wade. Just in the legal community, does one recover from this? I suppose if she was no longer DA, maybe there's a private practice. But I don't know. I can tell you based off of what I know about journalism that if there's a large ethical lapse, a person would find it very difficult to find employment again. Not sure if it's the same way within the legal world, though. Let me know.
Yeah, I mean, there were questions that were raised in the opinion about a lapse of judgment, which I would separate from a question around whether there is an ethical lapse. You know, as it stands today, I fully expect, despite the fact she's gotten opposition, she has opposition from a progressive prosecutor on the left and then from someone on the right. I fully expect her to be reelected. The hearing was interesting because I think that there are some people who watched the hearing and it raised concerns for them about the district attorney and her demeanor in particular. But there's other people who felt exactly the opposite and who have rallied around her and are more enthusiastic than ever about voting for her. So different people have viewed this different, based on one's perspective, people saw that hearing differently. But she is very likely to be the next district attorney. And even if she were not, her standing in the Atlanta legal community, as it stands today, will remain strong.
Professor Fred Smith, Jr., professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta. We also heard from Sarah Forden, legal editor for Bloomberg News based in D.C. My thanks to both our guests for joining us today to talk about D.A. Fannie Willis, Fulton County, Georgia, can remain on the Trump election interference case, but either her or Nathan Wade is going to have to leave. This is Air Talk on a Friday. I'm Austin Cross. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. When we come back, we are going to talk about grief dreams. This is when a person that you've loved and lost reappears in your dreams. What it could mean and more. Coming up, stick around.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross on air and live streaming on Instagram at LAIST Official, LAIST Official. You know, a dear friend of mine lost her mother about a decade ago. And for anybody who has lost a parent young, you know how painful that can be. It's like one of your biggest cheerleaders leaves the field before life even really kicks off. She dreamt about her this week, and she posted about it on social media, and I'm sharing with some permission here. But in it, her late mother finally met her baby. They shared a cup of coffee, hugged, and for one matrilineal moment, three whole generations united across dimensions of memory and longing. Now, for those of us who have loved and lost, those imagined reunions, they can feel more real sometimes than reality itself, and there's a name for them. They're called grief dreams. We're going to talk about what they are, what they tell us about our grief, but this is where I want to hear from you. If you've had a dream or recurring dreams of a loved one talking to you, visiting you, especially if you found those visits meaningful to your life, to your grieving process, I would love to hear about it. We have a line open for you at 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. You can also share your experience, atcomments@las.com, but we would love to hear from you. Joining us to talk about grief dreams and their role in the grieving process is Joshua Black. He's a grief and bereavement researcher and host of the Grief Dreams podcast. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So just to start off, for people who've never heard of grief dreams before. Can you describe them a little bit and what the nature of them can be?
Yeah, so the term is a very general term that actually encompasses a variety of different dreams people can have after the death of someone they care about. And so that could be dreams that kind of represent what someone's going through in waking life. So it could be you may dream of, you know, running by a mountain, the mountain collapses on you. It can just really represent that heaviness of waking life. And then you can have these dreams where the deceased isn't present, but other people in the dream are commenting on the deceased. So it could be an angel or other characters. But that last one, the third form, is that when the deceased is present. And this is what people want to talk about. This is where the questions all lie, because they can have such an impactful moment in people's grief journey, positive or negative, depending on your take on the dream and what kind of dream you have.
I mean, each one of these dreams then can mean something different to people. They can, of course, attach a spiritual connection to them. Then other people might view it as just simply their brain creating these storylines. But the sorts of dreams that people can have, they can really vary based off of where a person is in the grief process, right? Because there's a grief, especially if you have a loved one who has not yet passed, but is getting close to passing. There's the immediate aftermath. And then there's the people who can visit you years down the line, right?
Yeah, and this is sort of the very interesting aspect of these dreams, because just through dream research, we would expect actually most people to have negative dreams of the deceased, because our waking life and our emotions can really affect our dreams, and it's called the continuity hypothesis. But what's very fascinating about these dreams with the deceased in it, it's actually more likely you're going to have more positive dreams when they're part of the imagery. And that goes against a lot of Western dream research. So there's something else going on. So there's different functions to these dreams, and that's why people will comment on that they are maybe visitations to them if they sort of see it that way. And they're, as you said, more real than real sometimes. It can be more profound in the sense of it feels different than a dream. It feels like they're talking this like the soul of the person. And I've heard this, like, you see this across cultures, but even like you have atheists also saying that they've having these dreams. And some of them actually will then believe in an afterlife because they're so profound and different. So this is definitely a human experience that we don't fully understand. But it's very beautiful because it has these like life-changing qualities to the very more comforting dreams.
This is so fascinating. 866-893-5722. We are talking about grief dreams. That's when a person that we have loved and lost shows up in our dreams, what it means, what it can mean for us. 866-893-5722 is our number if you would like to share. Rob is calling us from Glendale. Rob, tell us a little bit about your story.
Hey there. I really appreciate you doing this piece. My dad took his life when I was 16, and about 5 years later, I'm 53 now, fully processed it, and still have a relationship with him, I feel. 5 years after he left us, I was in a regular dream on an elevator. Suddenly the elevator stopped, and I knew it wasn't my choice that this door opened. And he visited me. He just stared at me, looking very sorry and offering me some groceries. And when I woke up, I was thoroughly positive he had truly visited me. I rationalized it away a little bit later on. My brain must have wanted it so badly that it wasn't really an afterlife experience, but I still wonder, and I'm very glad it happened.
Wow, Rob, thank you so much for sharing. Really quickly, what do you think that the groceries meant to you even when you woke up?
We went food shopping together when I was a little kid. Often it was, he was a very busy guy, traveled a lot. So those were some of our closer moments. And I think he wanted to be close again. Also just wanted to be a dad again.
Rob, thank you so much for sharing. That's Rob in Glendale. 866-893-5722 is our number. And we are talking about grief dreams. You know, Joshua Black, I have to point something out just based off of our last call, but also how I processed this conversation as we approached it, because there was a part of me that was resisting the term grief dream, because when you think that you've processed something entirely, when you processed a death, in my instance, when I feel that I've reached a good place with the passing of my father, for example, but as I started working on this and the emotions started to rise, I realized that it's always kind of something that's in the background, even if it doesn't pop up all the time. And so I have to ask you, do the dreams sometimes tell us what is really real about how we feel?
Definitely. I think dreams can be a good beacon of how we're truly feeling, because the world in itself is very chaotic and we have a lot of stresses and anxieties and a lot of things to do. But our grief is always there and it lasts our whole entire life because we're always going to miss them and we're going to have new moments that we wish they were there. And so these dreams can actually help us continue a bond and actually continue to help process and remember those who have died, which I think is a very beautiful thing. And as you said, like a lot of people think that, oh, I'm not grieving currently, so I must be over it. But no, we're always feeling missing them because we always love them, whatever stage we're in our lives. And you even see that at end of life where when people who are dying will have these dreams of the deceased, but the focus of them will change. So it's not really about your grief per se. At end of life, it's about sort of transitioning to basically from life to death. And they're reassuring you that it's going to be okay. So it's really fascinating as you look at these dreams over time, how the content changes based on what you need in your current life.
866-893-5722 is our number. We are talking about grief dreams. If you've had a loved one that you've lost that's visited you in a dream, and maybe you had an important or poignant experience from that, maybe you didn't. Maybe it had the opposite effect. I would love to hear about it. 866-893-5722. Rachel is calling us from Manhattan Beach. And Rachel, I understand you just had a dream last night.
I did. It was, and I just got into the car and turned the radio on, and you were on, and you introduced the topic, and I was like, whoa, this is such a strange coincidence. But yeah, I was in a relationship with somebody for about 10 years, like in our 20s and 30s, and he passed away when he was 36, so after we had already broken up, but he still was like what I would say like the definitive, you know, like formative relationship of that time in my life. And it was a very sudden, he died of like a brain aneurysm. It was just terrible. And he was an extraordinary person. Ever since then, I've had just the most intense dreams about him. Yeah. He passed away about it'll be 8 years next month. And just such vivid dreams about him, like, so consistently that at a certain point I actually found a therapist who was kind of like I looked for someone very specifically who was kind of more like a traditional analyst. So we talked a lot about the dreams and what they meant and what the feeling was that I had around the dream. And he actually helped me, kind of come up with like a way to consistently be able to relate to this person and like process the grief, because like we don't have so much of that in America, in our culture, you know. And we made like a little, my husband also, different person obviously, he also lost a brother when he was very young, and there are some, you know, important people who have passed in our lives, and so we made like a shrine to them in our house. As a way of sort of keeping, you know, like we have these dreams, but also like in our waking lives, we can, you know, keep them alive as well. And, you know, obviously when I wake up from one of these dreams that feels so real, and like you can hear the person's voice and you can feel, you know, their energy with you, it's so sad when you wake up, but it's also, I just feel grateful that I'm able to like spend time with him.
And to feel that presence again, it can be so, so nice just to be refreshed with a feeling that you haven't had, a unique feeling that you haven't had in such a long time. Rachel in Manhattan Beach, thank you so much for giving us a call. We're talking about dreams, grief dreams, what we've gotten from loved ones who we've lost, who have visited us in our dreams. 866-893-5722. If you've gotten something from a dream, or if you even have a question about it, we're talking about it with Joshua Black. He's a grief and bereavement researcher. He holds an MA and a PhD in psychology, I should put out there. He also hosts the Grief Dreams podcast, so a great guy to be cruising along with. Robert is calling us from West LA. And Robert, I understand that you have some reoccurring dreams, but they're actually negative and you want to change that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, My father recently passed, and I'm now having a lot of dreams about his father and his grandmother, who were all very important figures in my life. But every dream is about the crumbling of their respective homes and kind of, the loss that I feel about it. And so I wake up in a funk. And I've always been curious, how do I change that into something that I can enjoy having, being able to visit with them rather than feeling like such a tearing open of my sense of loss.
Robert in West LA, Joshua Black, who again holds a master's and a PhD in psychology. Any thoughts on how to maybe turn that around?
It was a couple things. And I think first is to just understand that you're grieving, and it definitely represents that aspect of yourself that you're going through, and to be kind, because grief takes time. And so understanding that can kind of reduce the distress of that. But also when it comes to looking at just recurring nightmares, one of the things you can do is called dream rescripting. And so you basically have your dream that you had, that nightmare, and you rescript it to something more positive, and you rehearse that throughout the day, and those dreams should change to something a little less distressing, or they sort of stop altogether. But just in my own research and podcasts, what I sort of seen over time is as your grief changes, your dreams will change. And so you're going to have more positive dreams moving forward. And just having the understanding that those negative dreams are really reflecting parts of your grief that you're going through.
That was Robert in West LA. Joshua Black, thank you for your answer on that. Let's go to Neil in Altadena, because someone that you were working with, Neil, as a music producer, passed away. What happened?
Hi. The great Jimmy Weibel, great jazz guitar player, used to play with Red Norvo and Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
He was dying of cancer in his 80s and had some music that it was unfinished, and I helped him finish a CD. And we made just 100 copies that he wanted to give to friends. And there was a box sitting in my living room for weeks, and I called him to see, well, what are we going to do with these CDs? And there was a message on his machine that he had passed, and one of his friends was going to host a memorial for him at Vitello's. And I'd kind of forgotten all about that. And the night before that memorial, he came to me in a dream. His head was as big as the sky. I don't remember him saying anything, but it was very obvious it was him. And that kind of woke me up to the fact that, oh, my God, the memorial. It was the next day, and I got the information last minute, and I was able to rush down there. They made room for me, and I was able to distribute the CDs to all his friends and loved ones, and that was crazy.
He was on your mind, Neil in Altadena. Thank you so much for sharing, Neil. Emma is calling us from Laguna Beach. And Emma, this is about your partner who lost his sister. What happened?
Yeah, so first I just want to say, like one of your previous callers, it felt almost meant to be that I turned on the radio to hear you talking about this topic.
I love it.
Like you said, it's not actually my own grief dream story, but about a week ago, my partner had a dream that his sister, who he had lost about 6 years ago, showed up in his life, and she was a doctor. And in the dream, she was a doctor. And in the time that we've been together, he has never really outwardly shown much of his processing of that loss. But he told me about that dream kind of first thing the next morning. And I could tell that he was just feeling kind of a lot more connected to her than I had noticed before. And he actually that day put on a bracelet that his aunt had given him a few years back after she passed that says sister on it and has a little heart with wings. And it's just kind of a reminder of her in his life. And he's been wearing it ever since. So I can just tell it had a really profound impact on, how he's feeling about that loss and his connection to his sister.
So wonderful to keep that connection alive. And, when you get those visits, you do feel that presence that can really help remind you of what an important connection that was. Pam is calling us from Santa Monica. Pam, you have dreams of a friend who you lost almost 30 years ago, I believe.
Yes, my best friend, Doug, I lost in 1994. and he comes to me in dreams kind of regularly. And the thing about most of the dreams is I see him, and then I think, well, wait a minute, Doug, I thought you were dead. What are you doing here? And he always has a great excuse. Several times he said, oh, I've been in the witness protection program.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I'm so glad to see you. So it's always a positive dream, and he always has a great, believable excuse. So I'm always glad to see him. I love dreaming about him.
It's Pam in Santa Monica. Thank you for sharing, Pam. Joshua Black, I think that this is such an interesting dream. It's similar to the dreams I'd have whenever my dad would show up, and that there's either no acknowledgement of the passing. He's just kind of a character in it. Or in the case of Pam, it was, wait a minute, you're no longer here. And then he's got some sort of excuse. Is there a sort of category for these dreams where either you're not really realizing or nobody's actually acknowledging that that person is actually gone?
Yeah, there's such a common sort of, theme that comes up where the deceased makes an excuse for, why they're there. And I kind of sort of look at that as it's like the mind kind of needs it to like carry on the story, because there's usually something that happens afterwards where it's like, they say, I love you, or there's like a message. But that's just like a little interesting kind of tidbit that you sort of see. And I think it more be more for the mind than anything, but it's also amazing and really kind of funny on what kind of stories that they can sort of produce in the sense of why they're still here, why they're talking to you right now in this moment, just to really get this message out that a lot of times it's just love, right? Like they want to share their love. They want you to feel loved. If you're spiritual, even just for you yourself to feel the love that's still present within you. And I think, life is so hard and grief is such a difficult process. To have this love, I think, is such a catalyst for us to be able to continue to move forward in life in all areas.
And mentioning love in a dream, Kadia is calling us from Southwest LA, and you dreamt about your mother who passed away about a decade ago, and she came just a couple weeks after she died. What happened in the dream?
So, yes, within the dream, it was the morning, all of us getting ready for work in this bathroom that all of us used, me, my mother, my sister, and my mother was in the mirror doing her thing, and I walked past the hallway, and I just stopped. And she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, what are you doing here? And then she's just looking at me quizzically, like, what's going on? And in my head, I was fully conscious. I'm dreaming. So no more conversation. I just went in and grabbed her and hugged her from behind. And she was, of course, still reacting like, girl, what's going on with you? And I didn't say anything. I'm taking it in because I had been wanting her to just come to me in a dream, whatever. Didn't expect it to be completely interactive, but 3D, squishy, motherly warmth, and I just waited for the countdown to wake up. And I woke up in the happiest tears of my life because I was like, yes, this is what I needed. And that was it. And though I had dreams of her and my father, because it'll be 10 and 9 years for both of them in June, my mother 10 years ago, my father 9 years ago. And the regular dream, though they were in a dream, that one was fully interactive, 3D, felt her body, felt whatever, and just, held on until I knew I was going to wake up because I was also conscious that I'm dreaming.
Kadia, I love that. The second you realized it, but you saw the opportunity, you just grabbed and you held on. It's so powerful. Irene is in Mar Vista. Irene, you dreamt of your father.
Did and my father died many, many years ago when I was a mid-teenager, very suddenly. And I dream about him rarely because it's so long ago, but recently I was having a rough time because of this and that. And that night I dreamed, it was a very short dream, I entered a room and there was my dad looking exactly as he had when he died. And there were no words from him. I told him I was delighted to see him. I couldn't believe it. And I'd been having a hard time. And he just opened his arms wide and brought me in and held me, gave me an incredibly warm and loving fatherly hug. Again, no words at all, but it was the most comfortable I'd felt in decades. It just felt like pure love. It was lovely.
Pure Love, Irene and Mar Vista. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody who's joined us for this conversation, including Joshua Black, grief and bereavement researcher and host of the Grief Dreams podcast. He's got a website that's griefdreams.ca. He holds a master's and a PhD, and he is really the guy to ask if you have dream questions as well. My thanks to everybody who has joined us. When we come back, we're going to speak with Beard Award semifinalist for Outstanding Chef, Rashida Holmes of Bridgetown Roti in downtown LA. Now's a good time to get on Instagram Live, LAIST Official, LAIST Official, if you'd like to see the goodies that we're about to chow down on. Back in 90 seconds.
When I feel blue in the night and I need you.
The LAIST Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAIST.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk here on LAIST 89.3. I'm Austin Cross. I'm just chatting with our next guest because it is Food Friday. I should mention that we are live streaming on Instagram at LAIST Official if you would like to see inside the studio and see what we are about to chow down on. But we are continuing our series this Friday of interviews with Beard Award semifinalists. And this week, the second of two SoCal nominees for Outstanding Chef, Rashida Holmes, chef and owner of Bridgetown Roti in downtown LA. Thanks so much for coming in, Chef.
Thanks for having me, Austin. Glad to be here.
Really appreciate it. Let's start with kind of the basics for people, though, because I had not heard of Roti until I heard about you, actually. Could you tell us what it is and, you know, kind of the inspiration for your restaurant with it?
Sure. So, Roti is basically just a flatbread. A lot of people know what it is. It's a widely used word that really just means bread. Origins are Southern Indian and Middle Eastern, but roti came to the Caribbean a couple different ways through migration of workers from Southern India to the British Caribbean islands for the most part. And that's why you have roti in places like Barbados, Trinidad, and Jamaica.
And your mother is from Barbados.
My mother is from Barbados. She was born in Christchurch. She immigrated when she was in her teens. And then on my dad's side of my family, I also have some Bajan roots as well as Trinidadian and Panamanian.
So what you specialize in are called paratha rotis. I hope I'm getting that right. But could you tell us how that's different?
Yes. So those actually aren't rotis. Those are patties.
These are patties. Those are patties.
But paratha rotis are made from laminating fat into the dough. So you get like a flaky texture in the flatbread. But there's lots of different kinds. There's dal puri rotis where you put yellow dal inside the dough. So there's all different types of rotis that are made throughout the Caribbean.
So give me your origin story, because I actually think that you might be the second or third Beard Award nominee I've spoken to that actually has a COVID connection to kind of the start of their story. Tell us how that happened.
Yes. So I had the idea for Bridgetown Roti like in 2019, mostly kind of did side gigs, wasn't really taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And then the pandemic happened and I didn't have a job anymore. So I kind of restarted the business selling the patties out of my house. And via Instagram, and people came and they showed up, and I sold out like the first month every weekend that I did it, and it just kind of ballooned from there, really organically.
And so I should mention, so patties are what you brought today.
Yes.
And they're these beautiful half moon kind of fat stuffed pockets that are golden brown, and I am so excited to dig into them. But can you just tell me about how you capture the essence of the Caribbean flavors, Indian flavors? What kind of inspiration goes into them?
A lot of my inspiration is my own family. I was born in New York, but we moved around a lot. I spent time of my childhood in Dallas. I went to high school in Baltimore area. So I don't really have like hometown food that I associate with. But the one thing that we always had was Caribbean food in our house over the holidays and for birthdays and things like that. So both my parents were pretty good cooks, and they both kind of pulled from their Caribbean roots to make our food at home. So a lot of what I do in Bridgetown is inspired by that. And then the rest is just, you know, 15 years working in restaurants and kind of putting those two things together.
Talking right now with Chef Rashida Holmes, who is a Beard Award nominee, one of two in SoCal for Outstanding Chef. And you've brought some patties today. Talk to me about what's in front of me right now.
Sure. So you have two different types there. The one on your right without the little line on there.
The fat one. The big one.
That's our signature oxtail patty. So that's filled with a curried oxtail, a green sofrito, and it's wrapped in a turmeric curry crust. It's my ode to golden crusts and like eating beef patties growing up. I just wanted to take a beef patty and do something different with it. And then the other one is a green curry shrimp patty. That's folded in with potato and then green seasoning, which is like a ubiquitous
green
seasoning that we do in the Caribbean. It's full of cilantro and parsley. It's got spanet in it, lots of thyme and garlic.
I'll say that just sounds so fresh and herbal, just by the way that you're describing it. So I'm gonna go ahead and take a bite of this. I'm gonna do it off mic, but can you tell me about some of the ingredients? I mean, I've been waiting on this oxtail, so I'm going to start with the oxtail. I was like, how did she know that I like oxtail?
Everybody likes oxtail.
Who does? And if you don't, you haven't had it yet. Yeah. But it's kind of a life changer here. But I'm also showing this off right now on Instagram. I should mention LAIST official if you want to see these golden half moon crispy and warm patties and this really fat one with so stuffed with oxtail that you probably couldn't get any more in there if you tried. Thank you. I love bang for my buck kind of dishes.
I try to do it. Try to do it.
As I try this, tell me about some of what I'm going to be tasting in here.
Sure. So the dough is a short crust pastry dough. We season that with a house-made curry powder and some turmeric to give it that golden brown color that you're tasting.
I'm getting the turmeric for sure.
And then inside, the oxtail is braised, seasoned overnight, and then it's braised in Blue Mountain brown sugar and chicken feet stock, as well as there's mixed in there is a green sofrito. So there's some Anaheim peppers, green bell peppers. There's some Scotch bonnet ginger. And a little bit of breadcrumbs to kind of soak the gravy up so it's all gravy inside.
I'm going to take a break from chewing just to say, this is nuts. This is nuts. Chef Rashida. Oh, my God. You didn't have to do it like that. Can I ask you, you mentioned chicken feet stock. Why the feet?
I like to use chicken feet for stock because it gives a really nice gelatinous texture to the stock. They're also really cheap, so it doesn't add too much cost to the dish, but it gives the oxtail itself has a lot of gelatin, so I'm just kind of building on the gelatinous with the chicken feet stock.
It's just such a pleasant experience. When would a person normally eat this? I mean, I know in LA, anytime's a good time, but based off of its historic roots, when would a person eat it? Is it a lunch? Is it a dinner? Snack? Breakfast? Where does it fit in?
I mean, it's an anytime, every time kind of a thing. I think the last time I went to Barbados, I think I had one for breakfast, lunch, and then also at like 11 p.m. at night at Oyston's Fish Market. So it's really just about, you know, when you can find them, you gotta put them in your mouth.
I know that was good. Talking right now with Chef Rashida Holmes, Beard Award nominee, outstanding chef for Bridgetown Roti in downtown Los Angeles, which is so close to me. I know I'm going to have to come pay you a visit. This next one you mentioned has shrimp in it.
Yes.
And the green sauce.
Seasoning.
Yes. Green seasoning. So you mentioned the cilantro is in there. There's some garlic. I'm going to try this one as I experience it as loudly as possible away from the mic. Tell me what I'm going to be tasting in here.
Yes. So it's a poached shrimp, and then the green seasoning is cilantro and culantro, or houndstooth parsley is also what it's called. So it's like a flat leaf.
Culantro.
Yeah, it's a flat leaf, also called shadow bene. Really, really crucial to that green seasoning flavor. There's chives in there, scotch bonnet, garlic, ginger. And we kind of blanch all that, blend it together into like a smooth paste, and then that gets tossed with that same green sofrito, potatoes, and the shrimp.
Oh my gosh, there's just so many different flavors swirling around in that. And then the shrimp kind of pops out at you, and it's like, surprise, there's also a piece of seafood in here. That is just a wonderful experience. I only have about 30 seconds left, but I got to ask you, now that you're nominated, I think again, your second time, Outstanding Chef, and clearly very warranted, how you feeling?
Good. You know, Bridgetown has been and still is technically a pop-up for the last 4 years, so we're excited. I'm excited about the nomination. I'm excited that people are excited about Caribbean food. I think that's what motivates me the most is more Caribbean food in L.A., and we will be opening up a restaurant this summer in East Hollywood, so look out for that.
We are ready. Well, when that happens, you got to come back, okay? I'm going to try more of this. I'm Austin Krause talking with Rashida Holmes, chef and owner of Bridgetown Roti in downtown L.A. Rashida Holmes is nominated for Outstanding Chef. That's just incredible and clearly warranted. I should mention some breaking news, by the way. 32-year-old defensive lineman Aaron Donald has announced his retirement after a 10-year career with the Los Angeles Rams. We're going to hear more about that today on LAist as well. Thanks so much for hanging out. Film Week comes at you next.
How to LA is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. And I'm joined by critics Andy Klein of AV Club, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and the author of The Hollywood Heretic Substack, and Charles Solomon, Animation Authority, who writes for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with the Michael Keaton directed and Michael Keaton starring Knox Goes Away. The mystery thriller also stars James Marsden. The film was written by Gregory Poirier. Wade, what did you think of Knox Goes Away?
Really an intriguing film. And, you know, this is only Michael Keaton's second film as a director. His first one was in 2009, The Merry Gentleman, which is also about a hitman who is facing life struggles. And that's what he plays here. So I find this really interesting that Michael Keaton, as a director, is compelled to do these films about hitmen. Very interesting, but a very different kind of a hitman. In this case, this is about an aging hitman who has he's coming down with dementia, with an accelerated, very, very aggressive form of dementia that's even worse than Alzheimer's. And at the same time, his estranged son comes to him with troubles, and he has to now deal with working over his relationship with his son, repairing that relationship to some degree, rescuing him from the problem in which he finds himself, while at the same time preparing for his deterioration and the last sunset of his life. It's a very meditative film. I wouldn't say that it has all of the action elements you normally expect out of a hitman movie, but it's very well done. Michael Keaton is a much better director than I think people realize, because he's only made two films in, you know, a decade and a half. But I'd like to see him direct more and not be a hitman.
All right. Knox Goes Away. Andy.
Yeah, I like this a lot, too. And the basic hook is very similar to, you may recall, Liam Neeson in Memory, where he had Alzheimer's, and that was a remake of a Flemish film, which I think we also reviewed on this show back 10 years ago or something. But given that the Keaton character has Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which essentially he's beginning to be forgetful, but he's got a couple weeks left, that it's going to progress that quickly. So there is this constant sense of tension as to whether he is going to be able to pull off what he needs to do to help his son. The plot, I don't think it'll ruin it to say that it's a little bit of Witness for the Prosecution.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But it keeps you guessing. You don't realize what's like in Witness for the Prosecution, what's happening until the very end. And Keaton is real good in it and, yes, directs it very well.
The film is Knox Goes Away, directed by Michael Keaton, who stars in it. Gregory Poirier, the screenwriter. It's rated R. It's in select theaters. American Dreamer, a comedy starring Peter Dinklage, Shirley MacLaine, Kim Quinn are in the cast. Also appearances by Matt Dillon and Danny Glover. Paul Dechter, making his feature directorial debut, is at the helm. And Theodore Melfi, the screenwriter. Andy, what'd you think of American Dreamer?
I thought this was a lovely film. Peter Dinklage plays a really bitter, nasty, just down in the mouth guy. He's an economics professor, and he's also a writer. And he is desperate to own his own home, and he gets this weird arrangement with Shirley MacLaine, who is, you know, in the film supposed to be 90, which I guess she probably is. That she has this huge, beautiful house that she will sell for a song as long as she can also live there until she dies. And he figures, well, she's not going to last long. But what happens, of course, is the two of them bond. And it becomes really a struggle between Peter Dinklage's character and the litigious daughter of Shirley MacLaine. But it also becomes this kind of romance between Peter Dinklage and Shirley MacLaine, which is very tastefully put there. And again, lovely is the word that comes to mind. It reminds me of the last Peter Dinklage film I reviewed, which was the one with Marisa Tomei. I don't remember the title, which was, again, a similar thing where he's a down-and-out guy who somehow finds life renewal. And as usual, he is terrific. And Shirley MacLaine is Shirley MacLaine.
Well, and this is based apparently on a true story told on the public radio series This American Life, which we carry here on LAist 89.3. And so fascinating that they adapted that story from radio into the feature film. The movie you're thinking of, the previous Peter Dinklage film you liked so much with Marisa Tomei, was She Came to Me. Well, that was the film you were referring to.
Thank you.
The new one, American Dreamer, starring Peter Dinklage and Shirley MacLaine, is rated R, and it's at Lemley's Monica Film Center and the Town Center 5 in Encino. It's also available on demand at home. Demon Slayer to the Hashira Training is a Japanese animated film directed by Haruo Sotozaki. Charles, please tell us about it.
Well, the series Demon Slayer Kimetsu no Yaiba is hugely popular. Both the animation and the manga sold like 150 million copies worldwide. This is not a real film. It's the last episode of the third season of the show and the first episode of the fourth season of the show just spliced together. So it opens very powerfully. Tanjiro, our hero, who is the demon slayer of the title, of course, finally manages to off the very powerful demon he's been fighting for some time. There are lots of complications surrounding it. And so that's all very dramatic and very dynamic. But the new season starts much more slowly. Tanjiro spends a lot of the next close to an hour in bed recovering from his battles while these mysterious people, the Hashira, are setting up new levels of training for him and his friends to be able to fight even more powerful demons. And that will be the fourth season of the series. So if you're a fan of the series and know the characters and what's been going on, you'll have a great time seeing it on the big screen. If you're not familiar with the story, you're probably going to be somewhat lost.
All right. And what's your sense of how this will look on a big screen, Charles, since it is a television anime series and episodes that were made for that?
Well, we've come a long way from when things like the original Dragon Ball were shot in 16 millimeter. So I think it will look good. The one caution is that particularly the first half of it is quite violent, where they're hacking demons apart and cutting heads off, and that's still not enough to kill some of these creatures. They're very stubborn, you know. So I think it will look good on the big screen. The designs are solid and are interesting. So I think it'll work fine. Again, but if you need to know where you are when you go in.
All right. It's in select theaters. And speaking of the content that Charles was warning about, it is rated R. The animated anime series Demon Slayer to the Hashira Training is in select theaters. The romantic comedy Irish Wish stars Lindsay Lohan and Ed Spaliers. The film is directed by Janine Damian, written by Kirsten Hansen. It's streaming on Netflix, and one of the few films you'll ever see that's rated G. Wade, what did you think of Irish Wish?
I don't know that I realized it was rated G, but that good for Lindsay Lohan, going back to the G well. This is basically one of those wish fulfillment, careful what you wish for movies. It kind of sits in the same semi-genre as Big and Groundhog Day and movies where people wake up one day and everything has changed. In this case, Lindsay Lohan has a client who is, the love of her life, but he doesn't reciprocate. And she wishes that it were otherwise. And then one day wakes up and sure enough, they are in fact a couple, but maybe this is not what she was really hoping for. There may be someone else who is her real soulmate. So there you go. That's the setup. It's boy meets girl, boy loses girl, or girl meets boy, girl loses boy, girl gets boy back. It's, very formulaic. But it's not as kind of, as much as I felt like I should be annoyed by this movie, I kind of wasn't. So I give it props for that.
So Andy, were you annoyed by the Irish Wish?
A little bit, because it is so hackneyed. I mean, it really is by the book.
So by the book.
One after another. And you know from the beginning that this is the wrong guy. And when she meets the guy who will become the right guy, you know it from the moment they meet. It's filled with whimsy that I don't think is particularly well directed. I mean, there's St. Bridget keeps showing up, granting wishes, and kind of was tacky looking when St. Bridget would show up.
And we should say that the backdrop is a wedding in Ireland. So there's a lovely Irish backdrop and lots of brogues, but it doesn't have to be in Ireland. It literally could have been anywhere. It's not that special.
Yeah, except the Irish Tourist Bureau is going to love this.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
So it looks beautiful, as Ireland
gorgeous,
does.
Yes. But it was not funny enough for me. It was about as limp as rom-coms come.
Irish Wish, the romantic comedy starring Lindsay Lohan, Ed Spaliers, and Alexander Vlahos, Janine Damian, the writer. It's rated PG, or TVPG, I'm sorry. I'm so unused to saying G, I can't even say it without putting a P in there. The film is streaming on Netflix. The French horror film The Animal Kingdom is directed by Thomas Caillé, the film also co-written by him. It's in French with English subtitles. Andy, what did you think of The Animal Kingdom?
I like this a lot. It's not really a horror film. It's interesting. It's a monster film that is not so much a horror film. The setup is that there is some sort of disease or plague or something that is causing people to mutate in a way that mutations have never, ever happened in the history of the world, which is late-onset mutation, that adults are suddenly taking on animal characteristics and turning into half-animals or three-quarters animals or eventually totally animals, which makes communication with them really difficult. The hero of the film is this kid whose mom is one of the creatures, as they call them, who has escaped from the holding facility where they keep them. And a lot of the film is about the fact that these critters are not, in fact, a threat, except that people have cast them as outcasts. And that means that there's constant warfare and the animals defending themselves. And there's a brief moment where somebody says, well, we should do what they do in Norway, which is have a big game reserve for them and leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
But in France, apparently that's not working. And the son in the film, the son of Romain Duris, who is the big name in the film, begins to see that not only his mother has turned into an animal, but he's beginning to have the signs. It is not, in fact, a metaphor for puberty, which I kept looking for, but it is a really sort of humanistic film, or bestiality.
How are the effects? I mean, it sounds, Wade, like this is, you know, effects-wise, challenging.
It's challenging, but it's a French film. So it's not like, it's not done like a Hollywood tentpole film. It is much more focused on character and intimacy, and they don't sort of show off the effects the way that a Hollywood CGI monstrosity would. They give you glimpses, and they kind of tease you.
They work around it.
And that way, when they actually do show you a little bit more, it's that much more impressive. So they're much more judicious about it, more French, I guess. I mean, really, this is a mashup between a zombie movie like 28 Days Later, Island of Dr. Moreau, and X-Men. That's really what
it is. Yeah, I was thinking of Island of Dr. Moreau.
It's got all of those elements. The all of the themes in X-Men about being outcasts and minorities and so forth, that's all here. The only thing that bothered me is that we never get to the root of the how and the why this is happening. And I understand that when you're dealing with allegory and metaphor and these kinds of fantastic premises, it's almost beside the point. But at a certain point, it does nag at you because there are so many different types of mutations.
The Animal Kingdom is the film, a monster movie, as Andy Klein says. It's unrated in French with English subtitles. It's available at the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown L.A., and it's available on demand as well. We'll continue on Film Week with our critics. Next up is the Japanese animated sci-fi film Neon Genesis Evangelion. We'll hear about that and other films that are in the lineup when we come back in just 1 minute on Film Week on LAist 89.3. Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, and coming up just a little bit later this hour, we'll reprise my conversation with Christopher Nolan. Of course, Oppenheimer, the huge winner at last Sunday's Academy Awards. A chance to hear him talk about the making of Oppenheimer. Christopher Nolan in conversation with me later this hour. I'm joined by critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Andy Klein, and we're going to hear from Charles about the animated feature Neon Genesis Evangelion, the end of Evangelion, which is being re-released. This originally came out in 1997. It has two directors associated with it from the anime TV series. Charles, what do you think of the reissue of this?
Well, it's never been shown in U.S. theaters before, and it's quite spectacular, quite weird, too. It's one of the weirdest films you will ever see. When Hideaki Anno ended his Watershed series Neon Genesis Evangelion in 1996, he said he didn't know what the ending was, that he'd just come out of a severe depression. He didn't know what became of these characters. So the ending didn't satisfy anybody. He recut the last episodes as one feature that was Death and Rebirth in 1997. Still didn't work. He did a completely different film later that year, which is End of Evangelion. And it is, the only thing I can compare it to is animated schizophrenia. There's all sorts of art styles. Some of the last part of the story is there, but then you have characters fusing with supernatural creatures. There's Kabbalistic legends thrown in. There's Christian apocalyptic theology. And it's, as I said, one of the most bizarre films I've ever seen, and it ultimately means whatever you care to read into it.
Wow. Neon Genesis Evangelion, The End of Evangelion, getting its U.S. theatrical release. It's rated TV-MA in Japanese with English subtitles, and this, again, was created back in 1997, though it's the first theatrical release here in the U.S. It's in select theaters 2 days this coming Sunday and Wednesday of next week, March 20th.
The Canadian romantic comedy French Girl stars Zach Braff and Evelyn Brochu. The film's written and directed by James A. Woods and Nicholas Wright. Wade.
It's Meet the Parents. It's Meet the French Canadian Parents. But otherwise, it's exactly the same movie. Zach Braff plays the Ben Stiller part. Evelyn Brochu, who is on television, Orphan Black, some people may hear, wonderful French-Canadian actress. She's in the Terry Polo part. She even looks a little bit like Terry Polo. So they're not even trying to hide this. And the wonderful but strangely named French actor Luc Picard, not Jean-Luc Picard, but Luc Picard, plays the De Niro part. And it's got a few other interesting twists to it. The idea here is that Zach Braff and Evelyn Brochu, their wonderful relationship until she gets a job offer to be a chef at a fancy restaurant from an old friend in Quebec. So they go to Quebec City and meet the parents and the whole thing. But her old friend is Vanessa Hudgens, who's also a former lover. She's never told that to Zach. So that twist then becomes the tension, the generator of tension for the rest of the film. Otherwise, it's perfectly charming, but if you've seen Meet the Parents, you've seen this movie.
All right. The film French Girl is rated R. Again, it's written and directed by James A. Woods and Nicholas Wright. It's at the Regal Long Beach and available on demand starting Tuesday of next week, March 19th. The Prank, a comedy thriller starring Rita Moreno, Connor Kolopsis, and Ramona Young. The film directed by Maureen Barucha and written by Rebecca Flynn White and Zach White. The Prank, Andy.
I enjoyed this film, and a lot of it was Rita Moreno, who was probably 90 when this was filmed a couple of years ago. She's 92 now, and she's quite credibly playing a high school teacher.
We just saw her at the Oscars as one of the presenters.
And she is really the heart of the film. She plays the nastiest teacher in the world. She's going to flunk everybody in the class because one kid cheated, and it's college admissions time. And so the hero and his best friend, who is a hacker girl, decide to play a prank, which is the hacker fakes photos of the teacher with a student who mysteriously disappeared and fakes romantic notes between them and essentially sets up on the dark web this rumor that the teacher killed this kid. And the most amusing thing about the film probably is that all the cops and all the news people on local news all had her as a teacher. So they're all totally sympathetic to this rumor. Like, yes, she was the meanest teacher I ever had. I wouldn't put it past her. And then the teacher's husband dies of a heart attack from the stress. And that is still a comic point in the film. They try to retract this thing, and it doesn't work. And then the kid she supposedly killed turns up, but then things go crazy. Okay. I enjoyed it. I thought it was very funny, and it's just grand to see Rita Moreno chewing the scenery here.
The Prank is the film starring Rita Moreno. It's rated R. It's in select theaters. The comedy Snack Shack is set in Nebraska City, 1991. Connor Sherry and Gabriel LaBelle star. Adam Remeyer is the writer-director. Wade.
Really a mixed bag here. At first, I wasn't liking this film at all. It's a coming of age film, period coming of age. I hate talking about the 90s as a period. It's very disturbing.
Just the other day.
But it's a period coming of age film set in the 90s. Two friends, Connor Sherry and Gabrielle LaBelle, kind of bad kids. They're always gambling and smoking and running schemes and scams. And they are finally given a chance to be a little bit legit by running the Snack Shack during the summer at the local swimming pool. And introduce romance, one girl, two boys. And the girl, Mika Abdallah, is amazing. Absolutely a revelation. Going to be a huge star. She steals the film. absolutely steals the film. Camera loves her. She loves the camera back. I mean, it's really a discovery.
How what's the age range of these young people?
Like 15, 16,
okay.
I guess it is.
So they're teens. Yeah,
they're teens. She is absolutely astonishing. The two boys, what's interesting, Gabrielle LaBelle played the young Steven Spielberg in The Fablemans.
Oh, yeah.
Totally different here. You forget the other part. I mean, he's very good. He's so dislikable here. He's so conniving and so completely amoral that it just erases that other performance. So to that degree, even though I didn't like the character, I'm very impressed by him as an actor, that he's able to do this 180. Very, very, very sharp. But, you know, the film has some wonderful coming-of-age moments, very soft, you know, earnest stuff. You know, the old-fashioned young love stuff is very well done. But when they're really trying to play up just how crass and coarse these boys are, then it really feels like it's trying too hard. So it never quite gets it right, but there are merits that are worth watching.
Snack Shack, the comedy, is in select theaters. It's rated R. Exuma is the story of a wealthy Korean-American family in Los Angeles. The film is written and directed by Jae Hyun Jang. Andy, what'd you think of Exuma?
I wish I'd liked it more. It has a slow-building creepiness, and it stars Choi Min-sik from Old Boy, who is a favorite Korean actor of mine. But it is one of these films where, as in Poltergeist, the people who are supposed to be the experts at dealing with the supernatural stuff keep finding out that they're wrong, and more complications happen, and probably two or three levels too many complications that pushes the film to over 2 hours. I like I say, there's a certain creepiness, but I can't strongly recommend it.
All right. What about Korean culture? I mean, are there interesting aspects of that, you know, that are in the film?
I don't know if this stuff is
or just
is
made
real.
Up for the movie.
I think it's all about geomancy, which is where you place the graves in a fortuitous position. It's like feng shui for grave sites. I don't know if that's real or not.
Exuma is the film. It's in select theaters, and it's unrated. Hundreds of Beavers, an action-adventure comedy, which stars Olivia Fraves, Wes Tank, and Doug Mancheski. Mike Cheslick is the director and co-screenwriter of the film. Wade.
I hated this movie.
Oh, gosh.
I really did. And I'm going to let Andy speak for himself on this. But, like, because if you were to say this movie is like like a healthy helping of Guy Madden and Chuck Jones with a side of David Lynch, that's tailor-made for Andy.
Yes.
I will let Andy address why this does not meet those high standards. That's what they're trying for. I think this could have been a charming 10-minute short. As it is, it's like one guy who discovered some digital tools that he could sort of blue screen himself and do all kinds of fun tricks with, and then dress a bunch of people in some beaver costumes, and then let's tell a story about a guy, a trapper, who's got to defeat an army of beavers, which basically consists of his friends in beaver suits. At 105 minutes, it makes you homicidal.
impressed you stayed with it, Wade.
It's just unbelievable. It just taxes every ounce of patience that a human being can muster.
Andy. Yeah, I loved the title. I saw the trailer and I thought, black and white, you know, slapstick comedy, sounds great. It is indeed awful. The jokes, a lot of actual lifted jokes from Roadrunner cartoons, which not only don't work in live action, but the timing isn't. Chuck Jones knows to a frame how to time those things. And these jokes just fall flat, and it goes on and on and on
forever.
And never gets any place.
But as you bring this up, and Wade, you mentioning about the mashup of the three directors, I keep thinking, what would a movie like that puts Chuck Jones, the great Warner Brothers animator, together with Guy Madden and David
Lynch? I don't know if it can succeed, but boy, I'd like to see somebody try better than this.
The film we're talking about is Hundreds of Beavers. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and Lemley's Glendale location as well. The Neon Highway stars Bo Bridges, Rob Mays, and Sam Hennings. William Wages is the director. It's a film that has music at the center of it. Bo Bridges playing a washed-up legend of a singer
Claude Allen. This about Nashville and pitching songs and the like. Wade?
Yeah, Bo is trying to win an Oscar for playing a washed-up country singer like his brother. Not going to quite do it here. He's very good, but he's really the best thing about this. It's about a young aspiring singer who has some tragedy in his past, and he meets this washed up old, you know, Nashville legend, played by Bo Bridges, and they team up to make the younger guy's song a hit. But of course, Nashville today is not what it was when the Bo Bridges character was in his prime. So there are, you know, all kinds of hurdles along the way. Relationship kind of builds and falls apart and comes back together. It plays up a lot of cliches in this kind of a genre. But if you're not the song is very good, by the way. I mean, the main song that this all built around is a terrific song, but it's a little flabby narratively. It just can't quite find its momentum. It can't quite find its narrative groove. And if you don't love country, you're not going to love the film.
It's too bad. When I saw this on the list, I was hopeful. Yeah. Bo Bridges. I thought, yeah, okay, this sounds like a strong character.
And it is. He's very good in it. It's just, it's,
you know,
a
fabulous Baker Boys. He was terrific.
Oh my gosh, so good. But yeah, it could have used some tightening. I think maybe some judicious 15 minutes worth of editing, it would pull this thing together.
The Neon Highway film we're talking about, rated PG-13 at the AMC Burbank Town Center, and the documentary streaming on Peacock starting next Monday, Stormy, which looks at Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, unless if you didn't live through this for the past 8 years or whatever it's been, this would probably be a revelation. But it's just too close. We've seen this on the news. There's nothing new here until they get a little bit into her private life, her marriage, the way that it falls apart, and some of the affairs that are party to that. The film kind of finds its footing only in the last 20 minutes, where she is humanized. You see her crying. You realize she's a mother. She loves her daughter. Her family's messed up. She's deeply flawed. And this entire affair, she was taken advantage of. Everything to do with Avenatti and Trump. She wishes none of it had ever happened. And you do realize she's quite vulnerable and oftentimes her own worst enemy.
Stormy, the documentary, is streaming on Peacock starting next Monday, March 18th, rated TVMA. All right, it's Film Week on LA, it's 89.3. Larry Mantle with our critics Wade Major, Andy Klein, and Charles Solomon. Coming up next, I'm going to be talking with Christopher Nolan as we reprise an interview with him from, of course, prior to the Oscars. And then Oppenheimer, his film, of course, had a very huge night, including Best Picture. He won Best Director after all the nominations that he had received. He finally wins it this time. And, of course, the acting performances honored as well for the film. So we'll talk with him about everything involved with Oppenheimer. 7 total Academy Awards for Oppenheimer at last Sunday's Oscars. It's Film Week on LA, Estadio 9.3, our interview to come in just a few minutes.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on LA, Estate 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's continue our conversation with Oscar-winning director Christopher Nolan about Oppenheimer. I spoke with Nolan back in July about the challenges of making the film, what he brought to it to give it a sense of authenticity, and the high drama that's part of the story. Share with us how long it took to put that all together. I can't imagine the complexity of shooting that.
Well, we knew that the Trinity test had to be a showstopper. It's the hinge point of the film, the drama we portray. It's also, and we just passed the anniversary of the Trinity test, it's the moment the world changed forever and will never change back. And so it was something we put a lot of attention in right from the beginning. A lot of attention to how we were going to build the tension around it. A lot of that, I think, is about the process of what goes into assembling the device, building the tower, you know, putting the device up there, all of the security protocols, the safety protocols they went through to try and conduct this, and all of the different things that could go wrong or could have gone wrong. Not least the idea that they could have destroyed the entire world with the test itself. So I, very early on, I showed the script to my visual effects supervisor, Andrew Jackson, and said to him, let's try and do this with no computer graphics. Let's take that off the table and let's look for analog methods that would have a bit more bite to the imagery. We knew that this had to be absolutely beautiful, terrifying in equal measure. And so looking for real-world solutions, some very microscopic, you know, to portray large things, some very large explosions with a lot of different mixtures of whether it's, you know, magnesium flares and petrol explosions with black powder explosions, things like that. All of these different techniques coming to bear to produce this complicated montage of how to get across the beauty and terror of what these scientists were experiencing. And by using analog methods, by having real gigantic explosive events, you know, it meant we were out in the desert with the cast in bunkers, the way the scientists of the Manhattan Project would have been on that night. And obviously what we were doing had to be done very carefully and safely. Mm-hmm. So there's a tension around that when you do those things on set that, in some small way, I think gave us all a taste of what it must have been like to be out there in that desert on the night of Trinity.
I can't imagine, you know, with all the safety protocols that you're describing, working with explosives able to do real damage. When you actually did detonations for this, what that must have been like. Can you share how many times you actually detonated to get the look of what you want?
Quite a few. There's a fair amount of explosives used. And because, of course, as you know from having seen the film, the event has to be seen from a lot of different points of view. So there were scientists in the control bunker to trigger the actual test. They were the closest, Oppenheimer and some others. And then there's base camp, which was another 5 miles away from that bunker. And then there's a position on the hilltop where a lot of the other scientists were watching from much further away. And one of the things we tried to do in the film was to get across the magnitude of the event, to try and see it from these different perspectives. And so it involved a lot of different coverage, a lot of detail work, as well as the large explosions from very different points of view.
Well, and with the large format you shoot on and with multi-channel audio, it is so immersive for a viewer sitting there and as though you're there in the bunker, and the concussive sound and the light flash, all of that is extraordinary. And I just thought, how different would this film be if you shot this to stream as opposed to large format on a big screen, theatrical experience? It just, if you took the same script, it would not be the same film.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, it's made for the big screen. We've tried to have an epic telling of the biggest story I know of, you know, a story that changed the world that we all live in and always will live in. And that's what cinema could do. That's what the big screen can do. And for me, there's been too much of a tendency of late to try and divide movies into different categories that we decide, oh, well, that requires the big screen, that's for the small screen or whatever. I think really movies can be anything. They could take you anywhere. They could put you in any time or place and make you feel something. And, you know, I think for me, there was no question that this story should play out on the biggest screen possible.
We're talking with Christopher Nolan, the writer-director of Oppenheimer, which opens today. And our Film Week critics told us all about it earlier this hour, and we have the opportunity to talk with Chris Nolan about his film. Chris, just in closing, I wanted to ask about your wife, Emma Thomas, because she's a big part of your team working with you on all of your films, and to have in-house, so to speak, a collaborator on these projects, how does that change your work?
It's tough for me to answer how it changes my work because we've always worked together. So Emma's been producing my films since we were students together in college. And so I've been fortunate to have a partner working with me with, you know, an absolute focus on, you know, getting the best possible telling of any particular story. And she's simply the best producer there is. And so I'm very lucky to be working with her in that regard. And having, you know, a family atmosphere to things. You know, we work a lot with crew members that we've worked with for years and have real familiarity with and real affection for. That gets you through the tough times, and feeling that you have support there rather than competing egos, which can happen on film sets. It keeps things focused on the storytelling, on the film that we're trying to get on screen. And so I'm extremely lucky to have Emma and all the rest of the team I get to work with. You know, it makes my job much easier as a director, and it allows me to focus on the things that matter.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Film Week and talking about Oppenheimer, an extraordinary achievement, and we appreciate your joining us to discuss it today.
Thank you.
That's Christopher Nolan, writer-director of Oppenheimer. Great to have you with us for Film Week on LAist 89.3. Reminder, the entire program available for download wherever you get your podcasts or at LAist.com. Have a wonderful weekend. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's continue our conversation with Oscar-winning director Christopher Nolan about Oppenheimer. I spoke with Nolan back in July about the challenges of making the film, what he brought to it to give it a sense of authenticity, and the high drama that's part of the story. Share with us how long it took to put that all together. I can't imagine the complexity of shooting that.
Well, we knew that the Trinity test had to be a showstopper. It's the hinge point of the film, the drama we portray. It's also, and we just passed the anniversary of the Trinity test, it's the moment the world changed forever and will never change back. And so it was something we put a lot of attention in right from the beginning, a lot of attention to how we were going to build the tension around it. A lot of that, I think, is about the process of what goes into assembling the device, building the tower, you know, putting the device up there, all of the security protocols, the safety protocols they went through to try and conduct this, and all of the different things that could go wrong or could have gone wrong, not least the idea that they could have destroyed the entire world with the test itself. So I, very early on, I showed the script to my visual effects supervisor, Andrew Jackson, and said to him, let's try and do this with no computer graphics. Let's take that off the table and let's look for analog methods that would have a bit more bite to the imagery. We knew that this had to be absolutely beautiful, terrifying in equal measure. And so looking for real-world solutions, some very microscopic, you know, to portray large things, some very large explosions with a lot of different mixtures of whether it's, you know, magnesium flares and petrol explosions with black powder explosions, things like that. All of these different techniques coming to bear to produce this complicated montage of how to get across the beauty and terror of what these scientists were experiencing. And by using analog methods, by having real gigantic explosive events, you know, it meant we were out in the desert with the cast in bunkers, the way the scientists of the Manhattan Project would have been on that night. And obviously what we were doing had to be done very carefully and safely. Mm-hmm. So there's a tension around that when you do those things on set that, in some small way, I think gave us all a taste of what it must have been like to be out there in that desert. on the night of Trinity.
I can't imagine, with all the safety protocols that you're describing, working with explosives able to do real damage. When you actually did detonations for this, what that must have been like. Can you share how many times you actually detonated to get the look of what you wanted?
Quite a few. There's a fair amount of explosives used. And because, of course, as you know from having seen the film, the event has to be seen from a lot of different points of view. So there were scientists in the control bunker to trigger the actual test. They were the closest, Oppenheimer and some others. And then there's base camp, which was another 5 miles away from that bunker. And then there's a position on the hilltop where a lot of the other scientists were watching from much further away. And one of the things we tried to do in the film was to get across the magnitude of the event, to try and see it from these different perspectives. And so it involved a lot of different coverage, a lot of detail work, as well as the large explosions from very different points of view.
Well, and with the large format you shoot on and with multi-channel audio, it is so immersive for a viewer sitting there and as though you're there in the bunker, and the concussive sound and the light flash, all of that is extraordinary. And I just thought, how different would this film be if you shot this to stream as opposed to large format on a big screen, theatrical experience? It just, if you took the same script, it would not be the same film.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, it's made for the big screen. We've tried to have an epic telling of the biggest story I know of, you know, a story that changed the world that we all live in and always will live in. And that's what cinema could do. That's what the big screen can do. And for me, there's been too much of a tendency of late to try and divide movies into different categories that we decide, oh, well, that requires the big screen, that's for the small screen or whatever. I think really movies can be anything. They could take you anywhere. They could put you in any time or place and make you feel something. And, you know, I think for me, there was no question that this story should play out on the biggest screen possible.
We're talking with Christopher Nolan, the writer-director of Oppenheimer, which opens today. And our Film Week critics told us all about it earlier this hour, and we have the opportunity to talk with Chris Nolan about his film. Chris, just in closing, I wanted to ask about your wife, Emma Thomas, because she's a big part of your team working with you on all of your films. And to have in-house, so to speak, a collaborator on these projects, how does that change your work?
It's tough for me to answer how it changes my work because we've always worked together. So Emma's been producing my films since we were students together in college. And so I've been fortunate to have a partner working with me with, you know, an absolute focus on, you know, getting the best possible telling of any particular story. And she's simply the best producer there is. And so I'm very lucky to be working with her in that regard. And having, you know, a family atmosphere to things. You know, we work a lot with crew members that we've worked with for years and have real familiarity with and real affection for. That gets you through the tough times, and feeling that you have support there rather than competing egos, which can happen on film sets. It keeps things focused on the storytelling, on the film that we're trying to get on screen. And so I'm extremely lucky to have Emma and all the rest of the team I get to work with. You know, it makes my job much easier as a director, and it allows me to focus on the things that matter.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Film Week and talking about Oppenheimer, an extraordinary achievement, and we appreciate your joining us to discuss it today.
Thank you.
That's Christopher Nolan, writer-director of Oppenheimer. Great to have you with us for Film Week on LAist 89.3. Reminder, the entire program available for download wherever you get your podcasts or at LAist.com. Have a wonderful weekend.